あ、ここいるんだ。
本当？見えないでしょ？どこにいるのかな？ね、見えない。
How you doing, Internet? It is June 19th, 2017. I had to look at that to make sure. I am not Austin Walker. I'm going to let you know that right now. I'm Danielle Riendo. I am covering for Austin Walker because he's recovering from, like, advanced E3. He has, like, a really bad case of E3. E3 got him. So you're getting me. You're also getting our awesome summer intern, Natalie Watson. Say hello, Natalie.
Hello, all. Yeah. How's it going?
Yeah, it's going pretty well. We were on the home team this past E3, but
yes.
we have a refugee from our away team here, Rob Zachney, who also survived E3.
I think it was easier for me, right? Because, like, I didn't have to go, like, climb aboard the giant metal tube full of sick people for 6 hours each way. So I think I probably got off lightly this E3, which is a first for me, really.
Oh, that's good. We're going to talk a little bit about our E3 experiences. We're going to talk a little bit about, you know, games we're excited about and actually remembered
yes.
from the show, which I think is probably a good idea. Then we'll dip into the bucket, and then we're probably going to... That's going to be our agenda for today. So Rob, you were actually there. Was there a game that really stood out to you, or was there an experience? Was it like a, well, I made it through. I survived, so that's what I care
oh,
about.
Oh, gosh. I'm probably dwelling too much on the last night just because I'm in the process of writing up that interview.
Sure.
So that's, like, that is a game that I am in a weird place with because the ideas sketched out are super interesting to me, but the ideas for the game design are, like,
yes.
super interesting to me. The ideas behind the game design I'm way more skeptical of, and then that also ties into... There are a lot of issues with people who sort of fall into problematic camps.
Sure. So should we lay this out just in case anybody doesn't know what the last night is?
I think we can give a really cursory précis.
It's cyberpunk game with some issues. That's all you need to know. All right.
Yeah.
Good. Go ahead, Rob.
Yeah. So it's a cyberpunk game with just a little bit of, you know, some light Gamergate. Background.
There's a little light Gamergate sprinkled upon it. Yes. Yeah.
A garnish.
Yes.
It's carrying a little baggage. And I think the thing that I'm really sort of wondering about as I think about, like, how to frame this and how to approach this moving forward is also, like, what we really make of people who believed and did shitty things but still have the potential to grow out and grow beyond that but haven't yet demonstrated that they're there or that
yeah.
they're willing to. That's something I worry about because I do fear that someone like this is, someone like Tim Sorrett is liable to just get dogpiled for months at this point.
Sure.
And I worry a little too much about, like, putting people in boxes from which they're never going to escape when they're still, like, in development people
right.
in some way. Like, it is going back to that, you know, early 20s, those are big years. Also old enough to know better.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's something I'm sort of wrestling with is I'm not sure this person deserves the benefit of the doubt, but I am sort of interested in, like, how you open a door for people to sort of, you know, salvage themselves.
To grow from, potentially.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have a lot of complex feelings about this game as well. Of course, the first time I saw it, it was a Game Jam game, like 3 years ago. And we had a whole goof on Idle Thumbs, actually, about this game. Like, it was a whole funny thing. Like, oh, I played this fun little cyberpunk co-op killer. It was this whole little goof that we had. And then we sort of learned about this person's, some of the things that they had said on Twitter, basically some very not awesome things. And so it's... It's this weird kind of thing where it's like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Where do I fall on this and where do I stand on this? And how are we going to kind of find our way out? How are we going to dig our way out of this situation? And speaking of sort of everyone in the entire situation, the creator and fans and sort of all of us in gaming, how do we find ways to rectify these situations, sort of as Rob is saying? So I don't have any answers.
Yeah. I mean, also, can the game, like, stand without its creator? It's like an
yeah.
age-old question of, like, the whole, like, death to the author argument. Like, I feel like games especially are so kind of – I feel like the creator or the developer is even more woven into the game itself or the work itself, medium itself, than other mediums
sure.
of, like, similar
similar, like, team collaboration kinds of
Yeah, yeah.
Deals.
So
yeah.
I feel like you think, like, oh, well, can the game be without its creator's ideologies or without its creator's
Which it seems to have. That's the thing everybody's kind of, I think, digging into. It's like, oh, some of the things they've said about the actual narrative of this game is that it's like a socialist dystopia. Where it's like, oh, no.
If it was like Flappy Bird, I mean, I think we could, I don't know.
Right, right. No, that's a good point.
If it wasn't a game with its own sort of ideology-based narrative or its own sort of social constructs within it.
Would it be the same conversation?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a good point.
Yeah, and I think... You know, something I was sort of mulling over as I was sort of approaching this and listening to this interview again, there's also an element of the cyberpunk dystopia, as written from a place of, like, kind of extreme privilege in some ways.
Yeah.
Like, the dystopian part of it is that it's a fear of losing what makes you special, what gives, like, you your privilege. Like, the fear of what does creativity mean in this world if everyone's just leading this life of leisure. Well, you know, I imagine a world where people have that opportunity and that freedom looks potentially a lot more creative to someone who is working 2 minimum wage jobs.
Yeah.
And that doesn't sound dystopian at all. Like, oh, what's going to happen to creativity in that world? Well, if you're coming to it from a place that's like hasn't had the luxury to like pursue your creative passions, that world actually becomes sort of more empowering. And so the dread behind a world like this is that, well, you know, I'm a graphic designer, you know, I'm a game designer, and I've won the marketplace lottery that lets me pursue this as my full-time job. But what if that lottery goes away? Then what? That's horrible. And it only looks horrible if you're really placing a value on the fact that you can do something and that others can't. And I think that's the other part that I think, and I'm not sure this creator's really self-aware of that or really perceives it. But like the more I think about it, the more that really seems like a major part of the issue. At this point.
Yeah, I completely agree. How many more artists would there be if we all actually had healthcare and, you know, a standard of living and that's not it, terrible and that sort of thing? It's, yeah, okay. Yeah, for sure.
I'm curious, like, because, you know, we went over this on the podcast last week, and Danielle, you and I have just had this conversation about still a young person, still very much in development, like, you got to give them a chance to sort of rehabilitate themselves. But then I am curious for Natalie's point of view, because, like, you're not one of the old
young person.
You're not old yet. You're not one of our
That's
old
your
crusty people.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of curious how many mulligans do you give someone that's an early 20s dude?
Yeah.
Who's done and said some shitty things.
It's difficult because it also really depends on who's listening and responding to this guy. Like, is it an echo chamber? Is it like people who are actively or constructively saying, like, hey, this isn't cool. Like, hey, this is actually not what you think it is. And I mean, I've had problems, like, it's like this idea of like playing devil's advocate almost. That's like very, very prominent. I've had a lot of, maybe not problems, but tensions with this like idea of playing devil's advocate in classrooms, in like, especially like my philosophy or critical theory classrooms, that people just want to kind of be the contrarian for the entertainment of being the contrarian and for the pleasure of it.
Yeah.
Ideologies are not something to like entertain yourself with.
Sure.
And I feel like unless you're being called out for it, if you're just like, if it's just reverberating back to you from your surroundings or from the people that you surround yourself with, there's nothing's going to change. So I think it's definitely worth, you know, continuing to have conversations with these people and just trying to kind of point out in like a constructive way, because I don't know, it's very frustrating when it like it comes with like a smirk or it comes with kind of like a cheeky sort of, that's what I think is more harmful almost, because it's like actively, consciously engaging in something that you know is counter or is
purposely trying to hurt instead of make some sort of steps towards positive. Yeah.
The devil's advocate position is like definitely the, you know, I'm not touching you of like ideology.
Yeah.
And it is done in that. It is done in that, hey, I'm actually providing you a service and you should be grateful because like I'm piercing your echo chamber and all I'm doing is just like letting the other side have its due. And I think, yeah, the more time goes by, devil don't need no fucking advocate. Like, devil's got plenty of advocates.
Yeah, correct.
I don't think we need you. So I definitely feel that, and that is a major feature of college life. This idea that the argument should be this magical space where feelings and identities never get caught up in it, and that is just a stone's throw from I don't understand why you're being emotional.
Yeah. God. Yeah. Which is in itself like the most sexist thing anybody can ever say, right? God, why do you have feelings? It's like okay, thanks. Human beings have feelings.
This is what sets us apart.
It's hard.
So yeah. I was at E3. Like we podcasted a lot talking
about
stuff.
There were a few of those. Yeah.
Yeah, and it went on. So like, you know, I think we have a good sense of like what I saw and what I was thinking about E3, but I'm curious, like from the home team perspective, like watching it at a remove, what was really sticking with you guys?
Natalie, it was your first E3, so I'm going to let you go ahead and answer that one first.
This was...
I think it was your first E3.
Well, I mean, I've followed E3 in the past, not from, I don't think as diligently or as meticulously as I followed it this time around.
Sure, sure.
This time around, the presentations I thought were like, all right, they're kind of typical present, except for the Devolver, obviously.
Oh, which that was a bit of a...
That was a bit of a sidestep into something else.
Sure.
But I was really fascinated by the inclusion of the Colosseum. This year, and like this idea of having all these like panelists and like series of panels to like discuss different topics in games, which isn't a traditional sort of thing of E3. So I had some reactions.
You wrote about the Neil deGrasse Tyson going toe-to-toe with James Gunn about critical reception of game, whether something can be good if it's successful or vice versa, basically, which was very interesting when that happened.
Yeah, I had a very strong reaction to that. Like, do we create like a one universal kind of criteria, metric of judgment for all mediums of entertainment, especially movies and games, since they're like coming into this like one space? They're starting to be like, James Gunn is sitting with, I'm sorry.
Kiki Wolfkill. Yeah, Kiki Wolfkill. Yeah, exactly. Randy Pitchford. James Gunn. It was Neil deGrasse Tyson. It was a very interesting mix of people at this Colosseum panel.
Yeah.
And it was ostensibly about
World building.
Right, of course. Yeah.
Which I don't really think they ever really talked about.
Ever addressed world building, yeah.
Yeah, I feel like most of the panels actually got away from, which is...
It happens.
Panels, I mean, it's quite difficult to keep to one topic, especially when you have people coming from so many different backgrounds.
Yeah.
And how much did they get to discuss kind of what they were going to talk about before sitting down to the panel? Like, I think that's super crucial to have the panelists in conversation with each other before sitting down to have an idea of what kind of questions are going to be asked by the host, who is Chris Hardwick in this case.
Yes.
Yeah, so I think the inclusion of panels I was really excited about, but I didn't watch, I don't know, there wasn't a single panel that I felt like, yes, like right on, things are being said here.
Yeah.
I felt like it was a lot of continuing with like the presentations, like a lot of like self-promotion, which is like fair, but not really like a discussion of concepts, which I was hoping for.
Yeah, that's more of a... You'll see if you continue to cover this world, but that's more of a GDC thing where things actually kind of get into the meat of development and ideas and that sort of thing versus a PAX or what this was, which was basically, the Colosseum was basically, it felt like a lot of PAX panels to me anyway, that more promotional element, which again, that goes along with E3 and so forth. Talking about sort of the shows and the expo kind of stuff, what struck me was both that E3 got extended for 2 days this year and also that most of the press events were actually shorter than usual. Not EA, but Bethesda was like a maybe 40 minutes, I think. Yeah. It was pretty quick. It was pretty much like trailer, 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 trailer. There wasn't like a... Last year at Bethesda's event, there was, you know, a Dishonored 2 sort of like beautiful walk through the levels. You know, it was sort of like a little bit of a level design dive. And that was my favorite part probably of Bethesda's event last year. This year it was like, here's what's up, here's what's up, here's what's up, here's what's up. And it stuck to a theme, that sort of theme park theme of Bethesda Land or whatever, which was kind of nice. So I dug that one for being fairly consistent. The Ubisoft event was much shorter than usual as well. I really missed Aisha Tyler from that because she usually does an amazing job kind of keeping things together. But it was also lovely because it was like a very positive event. It was very much like Yves was up there smiling, being a beautiful tiny man, and there was so much love in that room. There were two crying men, which was lovely, you know. And I don't say that to be facetious. It was actually very like very charming and sweet. There were two creators who Michel Ancel teared up at the reception of the Beyond Good and Evil 2 trailer demo. However, you know what they showed for Beyond Good and Evil 2. Mm-hmm. And it was David Solani, I want to say his name.
Yeah, I was about to look up his name.
Cool. I want to try to get it right. Mario versus Rabbids Kingdom Battle creator who teared up because Shigeru Miyamoto was talking so highly of his work. And it was like this really heartwarming... E3 is usually not a heartwarming kind of thing, but it's this was very like, oh, yeah.
Explosion, awesome.
Exactly.
Righteous.
It's a very, you know, like, awesome pool explosion. Yeah. It's very like that typically, but this was very like, oh, that was nice. And then all the developers kind of got up at the end and Yves was like, thank you to all the teams. They worked so hard. And it was like, oh man, this is really, I know it's a manufactured E3 thing, but it felt closer to home than most of those events. And then Nintendo had like a 20-minute presentation.
Yeah.
So everything was like
pretty
quick.
Typical of Nintendo. And Sony did like a huge pre-show, and
where half of everything they showed, anything under like a certain million, however many millions of dollars of budget, was like in the pre-show.
Yeah.
And then all the big
kind
budget
of
stuff.
Wacky.
Yeah,
and Nintendo did sort of the same thing with their post-show.
Yes.
They like announced, I think they announced the Mario Luigi Superstar Saga remake, or not remake, remaster.
Metroid 2 remaster, which Rob also saw at the show, playing the game. I heard about that. I saw that video. I made that video, actually. That was one of mine. So
I heard a lot about it.
I heard all about it. If you haven't heard all about it, you should totally go to our YouTube, Waypoint Vice. Also, right there on our website, waypoint.vice.com, where all of our E3 videos are. They're great. I don't know. I think they're
pretty nice.
They are plentiful, if nothing else.
There's so many great videos. I should probably do the shout-outs thing right now to everybody who helped cover E3 for us, our production team, to Dylan. I'm gonna shout-out to Tim also, just because, Tim, you're great. You know, he's making this podcast right now. But everybody did good work at E3. And unless we have other E3 thoughts, we should move on to the question bucket. Any more thoughts? Rabbi, you might be exhausted of thoughts.
I have no more thoughts in E3.
Thought it out.
That's good. Can't wait for next year. All right. All right, so we're going to take a dip, a little dip, a little dive, a little, you know, spelunking into the question bucket here. All right, we've got our first question. Dear Waypoint, does buying/playing/covering games that include voice actors who scab during the SAG-AFTRA strike help the anti-union position? Should the games press boycott buying and covering these releases? Thanks, James.
Wow.
James, starting off with a banger.
Yeah.
Right here.
Wow.
That's all right. So ideologically speaking, is this akin to crossing a line? Is buying the product, if you go into the supermarket when the workers are picketing and you buy your apples or whatever, is that, you know, that's one thing, I suppose, versus you're buying this product, but it's supporting these other folks. I don't know. This is a fine line here.
But we're also supposed to be kind of this, like, objective presentation of facts or news or...
Well, that's the journalistic, you know, that whole thing, which...
Also
is also
ideology.
Complex.
Yeah, so...
But I think it's a different answer depending on where you sit on this. Like, I think as journalists, no, you can't not cover it, because that's also a good way to not cover that it's a strike at all. Like, if you're ignoring the entire thing, then you're ignoring the implications of that. there are conversations to be had in journalism about who you give a platform to and the prominence you give certain opinions over others. That's definitely part of the conversation. But no, you like this thing exists. This issue cropped up, and it's worth discussing. And I think probably that performance is going to be under a lot of scrutiny. That is going to be a performance that critics are probably going to be listening to pretty hard.
I think that's fair. I know somebody here in chat is making a little bit of a joke about it, but since what if I buy the game but I put it on mute? And that's sort of like a very, I know it's a joke, but it's actually kind of like, is there a way of doing this and like having your cake and eating it too, yeah, kind of thing? I don't know if that's.
I don't think there is.
I don't think there is either.
This is awkward, right? Like this is, I think for a lot of reasons, the kind of game we are happy exists and want to play and support. And at the same time, there are labor practices behind that game that we might also not want to support.
Yes.
And that's, you know, there it is. Like, this is the shitty thing about voting with your dollars. Like, what the hell are you voting for here?
Right.
Like, how do you vote for, yes, more stories of queer ladies, no to screwing over union workers?
Yes.
I don't know how to do that, but I think I would probably, if that's an issue you feel passionately about, you probably want to give it a miss. Like, you know, my New England buddies will remember this. There was a huge market basket strike
yes,
a couple of years ago. And that was one of the most affordable and best like grocery stores in New England. And we stopped going there for like 2 months because you either care about this or you don't. You can't be like, I care about it until it affects the thing I want.
Right.
And then to hell with it.
Right. Once things get difficult, that's when it actually matters to actually put action behind your ideology. I keep thinking of this, and I keep thinking about going even a little bit further with this question. Does buying a game from a studio that is known for bad labor practices or crappy labor practices, is that in itself kind of a negative thing? You know, I'm not going to talk about EA Spouse as if that's the only thing in the world, but during that time frame, were people buying EA games supporting these crappy labor practices? Is that how far this goes? Is that how far our voting with our dollars kind of goes down the line here? I don't know. Again, I don't have answers to these questions.
Yeah.
I'm just framing them.
I guess where I get uncomfortable with the limitations of this is a lot of times it feels like the powers that be want to make the people with the least power in a situation be the most complicit in the evils of it, right? The whole,
yeah,
like, you know, well, you know, you can have a higher minimum wage, but do you really want to be paying $12 for a Big Mac?
Right.
And, like, you know, the thing is, I think a lot of people would probably be willing to pay more for things that were more ethically produced and more, humanely produced.
If we actually had a system that benefited everybody in actual sort of concrete ways. Yeah,
yeah,
I like to think that.
Like, if my utility bill came with a, look, your carbon footprint's getting really, really bad, dude, and here's the thing. But instead, you don't really get that. And you're also told your individual choices are going to be kind of a drop in the bucket and kind of meaningless. So, yeah, I mean, we're somewhat complicit in that, but also who's the most complicit in it is people resisting labor organizing, resisting labor regulation. There's this interesting thing that went up, I think, last week about Elon Musk's Tesla factory in Fremont,
sure,
California. Have you heard about this?
I haven't heard about this.
I only heard sort of the headline version of it, but not the whole story.
Yeah, so this is increasingly looking like a cross-tech problem. So Elon Musk buys a car factory, but he's not doing it as a typical car factory. This isn't manufacturing. This is technology. So
yikes.
When he's running, so the UAW is kept out of the shop.
Sure.
And the stories coming out of the Fremont plant, and The Guardian did a really good report on it, are really bad. Like, it has something like north of 30% higher serious injury rate.
Oh, God.
Serious safety incident rate on that production line. And there's stories of people, like, passing out in the heat of the factory and just, like, falling on the floor and, like, you know, breaking their faces open. So there's ongoing, like, abusive labor practices. And the solution that Musk is sort of putting forward is personal responsibility. He is the owner, takes this seriously, and he's going to personally like check in on this and make sure things are on the up and up. But we're not going to organize labor around here. We're not going to introduce these regulations. We're not going to introduce like union observers. You know, we'll sort it out among ourselves. And so does that make everyone who buys a Tesla complicit in that? Sure, to a point, but let's not obscure who actually has the choice to decide how safe and humane the Fremont plant is, right? Yeah. Like, doesn't care how much you like his rockets. The guy sees a problem. He has a chance to do the right thing. He ain't doing it. I think the same thing happens in video games as well.
That's a really good point. All right, I'm gonna ask the next one here.
Yeah.
All right. I don't want to butcher this person's name. I'm going to give my best shot. It's from Yogyakarta.
Nope.
Yogyakarta?
It's from Steve in Yogyakarta.
Oh, it's from Steve in Yogyakarta. All right. Sorry, misread it. A little tired. E3, I have a little bit of the E3, too. E3 happened to me. The E3 definitely happened to me as well. All right, Steve writes, just a question about settings in video games. So, video games are made by large teams of people all around the world. Despite this, it feels like American cities are almost the default setting for modern video games. And often, when we get away from an American city setting, it's to enter a developing country as an American to kill lots of people and blow things up. Why do you think video games are so often set like this? Personally, I feel like video games are a perfect medium to take me to new locations, be them fantasy or real world. Despite Assassin's Creed's boring mechanics, and it's not really using its setting well, when I play those games for the first few hours, I feel like I'm in a place that's new, where I can see and hear things I've never experienced before in a game. I just don't understand why games so often shy away from showing us new places and exposing us to new cultures. Often this can mean setting a game in the same country as the development team is in, thinking of lots of devs in Canada. Don't think I've ever played a game set there. Thanks for taking the time to read my email. Hope y'all are having a good day. Well, thank you, Steve.
Thanks.
I think part of this here is the sort of will it play in Peoria factor of, you know, publishers not wanting to take massive risks with things when they spend millions and billions, I don't know, lots of money, many dollars on a thing. And they think, okay, what's the widest possible audience? Oh, yes, bland American culture. Yes, that's globalized. Let's go with that. Yeah, okay, Pittsburgh, whatever, middle America, somewhere in California, you know, whatever they think is sort of recognizable as like a bland, globalized American kind of city. I do think there's also the issue of developers, for whatever reason, not wanting to, this is funny, but not wanting to take on another culture, do it poorly, and get sort of blasted for it.
Yeah.
They're doing it by often sort of marginalizing everyone else. You know, of course, we all bag on, what is it, Ghost Recon Wildlands. It's Wildlands, right? Which is, you're an American, you come into another country and you're killing a whole lot of brown people, and that happens a lot in a lot of games. So they're doing this whether or not they are trying to do positive representation or not. So that's two things at play here. You folks have other thoughts?
I think you're definitely onto something. Like, the more interesting a setting is,
the more research you actually need to do.
Yeah, and there's probably more to it than it's just like beautiful geographically speaking, right? Like, a lot of times when we're talking about, oh, I'd love to see something set against, I'd love to see something set here in this place and time, it's usually not, I just want to go stare at, you know, pretty architecture. It's usually there's something happening in that era as well.
Yeah.
Assassin's Creed tries to have it both ways, where it's like, we're going to take this fascinating historical moment and say absolutely nothing.
it's
safely removed enough that they can get away with that. But like, if you know, if you wanted to do a story set in like, you know, Cape Town in the 1980s or something like that, could be a fascinating setting. But who, like, who would be making that game? Who's qualified to tell that story?
Right.
Yeah, that's also a very good point. Yeah, I think that the idea of not saying anything, or like that sort of standpoint, is definitely kind of one of the biggest motivators behind the reason why, like, AAA games follow such a formulaic sort of structure.
Or and like even narrative David Cage structure. This week saying, oh, you know, my game that clearly is taking on so many, you know, racial allegories with his with Detroit Become Human, you know, setting it the way it's set, the trailer, you know, starting with basically a you know, a it was basically like a spiritual song, right? It was like a slave time song, basically. I don't know the proper term for that, so I don't want to...
Like a spiritual.
Okay, spiritual. Yeah. And then saying, no, this doesn't mean anything.
Yeah.
Like, that is the most...
And it's like
inane thing you can say.
Yeah, it's such a cop out.
Yeah,
it's such a like it's frustrating. And I think this is how I felt watching the Far Cry 5 panel.
Sure.
Because I was really like, this is. I have so many expectations and so many hopes for Far Cry 5, and I felt kind of the same way that it was like, oh, this isn't like we like went to Montana and studied Montana, and so it's like. About Montana instead of it being about anything.
What it's actually
about,
maybe?
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
which is, like, so frustrating because you I mean, these people have the platform, right?
Yes.
And they have the resources and the ability to hire the people who have the personal experience or perspective.
Yeah.
And increasingly it's bypassed and it's what's safe. And so, you know, that's kind of frustrating, but I think Far Cry 5, we may be able to pull more out of it, not from the developer's voice, but from the player's voice or from like, not from the developer's experience, but from the player's experience, which I'm really looking forward to. And hopefully that remains true.
Yeah, the Far Cry series has always been so interesting because it feels like, you know, folks in my circles feel like 2, of course, is like the pinnacle of what it's doing and what it's saying, and then 3 was like a huge down point, and then 4 was like, all right, you're crawling out of this hole a little bit in certain ways, and now 5 is on the horizon as a, this could go great, or it could be the most bland say-nothing thing ever, and...
Yeah.
We're hoping for for very interesting and nuanced. I don't know, Far Cry. Everyone, thank you so much for listening to Waypoint Radio. Natalie, where can people find you online?
They can find me at on Twitter, at Natalie Watson.
Awesome. You can find me at Danielle R.I. You can find Rob at Rob's Acne on Twitter. Shout outs, of course, go to Tim Barnes, TimBarnes451 on Twitter. Shout outs to Dylan for producing this beautiful stream. And you can, of course, find all of our beautiful stuff. It's beautiful stuff. Waypoint.vice.com, new.donk.city. There's actually a list. There's a forum list of all of our awesome URLs, which is really nice. Of course, you can follow the usual folks, Austin Walker at Austin_Walker, Patrick Klepek at Patrick Klepek. Shout outs to Bowen. For letting us use his track Miss You off the EP Pale Machine. You can go to waypoint.zone/Bowen to listen to more Bowen, see more Bowen. Thank you all very much. Again, you can find us Twitter at Waypoint, Facebook at Waypoint Vice, YouTube at Waypoint Vice. We've got Instagram. We've got all sorts of good stuff. Thank you so much. And as always, be good or be good at it.